What is up, everyone? Welcome, welcome. What a day to be alive. We are here with the Databricks team. They've got some huge news that just came out, as you probably saw last week. And after we saw it, we said, you know what? Let's have a roundtable session about this, because there is too much news to let just slide by. I would like to bring out the Databricks team, but I'm going to do it in true MLOps fashion, and I am going to sing a little song about them to make us start off on the right foot. Hopefully you all are ready for this. You may not know what you're getting yourselves into, but let's get it rocking. If anyone has any key that they want me to sing this intro song for the Databricks team in, speak now or forever hold your peace. And if you want to prompt me, throw it in the chat. I am listening. Of course, C-sharp is going to be the go-to one. Here we go. C-sharp, minor. Can you all hear that?
Databricks is releasing models for the open source community. We got them here to talk with me. I wanna know, what do you call this model?
And to answer that question, we've got my good friend Denny Lee. Oh, where you at, Denny? Hey.
Hello, hello, hello. Hello. Great C-sharp. Thanks very much, Demetrius. Always glad to be hanging out with you, like usual. So if you don't know who I am, I'm just saying, hey, you said the intro, so I'll do it real quick. Name is Denny Lee, but apparently a developer advocate at Databricks. Demetrius and I have been guilty of doing many fun things together, and we're back at it again. That's probably all you really need to know. So,
what are we calling this model, dude? That you've got a big LLM out in the open source land, and I think that I pronounced it earlier, and you said, no, that's not what it's called.
That's right. It's okay. Now, of course, the name is DBRX, but I'm trying to make it a thing where we all say DABRX. Okay? So that's the idea.
It's going to stick.
DABRX.
DABRX.
I want it to stick. Everybody listening, DABRX.
Luckily for us, we've got some other people that have worked on DABRX and are able to. We're going to have, over the next hour or so, we're going to talk with some of the actual talent behind it. Look at this. DABRX just popped on the screen. Oh, my God. There we go. First up, I'm going to bring on to the stage AJ. Where you at, AJ? There he is. What's going on, dude?
Hello.
Tell us, what have you been up to?
So I guess first, quick introduction. So yeah, I'm AJ. I'm the engineering manager for the generative AI training platform team at Databricks. And yeah, I mean, honestly, for the past few months, it's been a lot of cranking away, making this model train, largely running all of the backend infrastructure for training it, making sure it works well, making sure the model is actually going.
You've had your work cut out for you. So I'm going to keep bringing the team onto the stage. Bandish, I know you're in there somewhere. There he is. What's up, dude?
How's it going, Demetrius? Glad to see you again.
You too, man. So give us the rundown. What have you been up to?
Yeah, I mean, I think we talked about 2-3 weeks ago. We'll caught up on a sleep a little bit, a little more gray hair after this. But yeah, so my name is Bandish. I'm another engineering manager at Databricks, and my team basically builds all the training tooling, like Composer, LLM Foundry, streaming data sets, for those folks following our open source tools that we use to train DBRX or DABRX, I guess that's what we're calling it. We're trying to figure out what to call it. We're trying a few different things off for size.
Yes. Well, I'm excited to talk about it. We got Abi. Where you at, dude? Where you at? There he is.
Hey, great to be here. My name is Abi. I'm an architect on the NLP team. I've been helping lead a lot of the modeling choices and development around DABRX, and it's been a crazy couple months to everything from pre-training, data prep, all the post-training as well. It's been a huge team effort. yeah, super excited to be here.
Excellent. Well, we've also got Davis coming on in just a second. We got to kick it off, man. Like, Denny, can you lead us through the sequence of events that has happened over the last month when it comes to DabaRex?
Well, actually, no. In all seriousness, I that's a great question, but I would rather have Bodish, AJ, or Abhi actually take care of it because they are integral for its creation.
I think when we look back at sort of, you know, last year, you know, originally we were, a lot of us came from the Mosaic team, and our goal was to really help people build and train their own models and build the infrastructure around that. And I think we got to this point where we showed that you can actually train, you know, up to GPT-3 quality models for a relatively low price. And as we looked ahead, you know, especially after we got acquired by Databricks, we really wanted to see, like, can we push the quality to the next level, right? Can we get to like 3.5 and beyond? And what were the different things that need to go into that? So a lot of it came down to obviously needing to scale up to bigger models, but to do so in an efficient way. So, you know, we really like dug into this new mixture of experts architecture, which I'm sure we can talk a lot about, which really helps us train higher quality models without increasing the cost too much. And that involved a lot of both research and engineering, figuring out how to make these models converge, figuring out how to actually train them at high performance on big clusters. And so we spent a lot of time like digging into the research. And then I say right about like, you know, around Christmas time, actually, that's when we decided, hey, we actually want to go for it. We want to try and build a new model that's way more powerful than our previous MPT series. And that's really kicked off this effort. So the past 3 months or so have been just round the clock, you know, research and engineering, trying to get DabaRex out.
So good. So we have a new person that joined us. Davis, can you give us a quick intro before we dive deeper into this? I know it's like we're taking one step back and two steps forward, but we're going to get there.
Okay. One step back and two steps forward sounds exactly like training a huge model. So it's pretty fitting. So yeah.
Seems like we're on point.
Yeah. So hi, I'm Davis. Good to be back here. I am a researcher at Databricks' Mosaic AI team, formerly Mosaic ML.
So I'm always interested in hearing, and Denny, feel free to jump in if you have any thoughts on this too, but when it comes to training one of these models and thinking about it, like, you did a lot of testing beforehand, right? And Abhi, you were just talking about how you at some point you were like, okay, we've tested enough. Now we think we can go for it. You have to make that gigantic investment into training the model. You have to be pretty confident that what's going to come out on the other side is going to be useful and going to make an impact. What are some things that gave you all the security to know that you can do this? Like, if you're going to invest this time and effort and resources into it, it's going to be good.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's like both the research and the engineering risks. I can talk a bit about the research, and maybe Bonish or AJ, you guys can talk about the engineering stuff too. So, you know, the basic thing we try to do, you know, is really nail down the recipe for modeling. So, you know, the architecture, you know, the choices of, you know, how much data to use versus the number of parameters. And we do a lot of these tests at smaller scale, and we try to basically benchmark ourselves against like other existing models out there and our internal benchmarks, you know, our previous MPT models. And we try to see that we're hitting the same quality as those other benchmarks, but doing with like much less compute or money than before. And so we do a lot of those experiments, you know, like at smaller scales, and eventually we start like kind of scaling it up and making sure that we're actually hitting the quality we expect. And that's what kind of gives us the confidence that like, hey, you know, now we're going to really crank it up and go 10x farther than we ever have before. It's just a lot of those little scaling experiments. That's the research. But on the infra, yeah, maybe someone else was talking about that.
Yeah. I mean, I'll jump in from the kind of the training side, right? I think, you know, research is really kind of pushing the frontier as far as kind of when we work with our research team, right? And I think that's like it's a really great kind of collaboration that we do, right? We innovate because customer zero is always research for us. And so, you know, I think sometime last year, Abhi comes up, says, hey, I got this MOE architecture. And we had just put out, right, MPT-30B and kind of riding that wave. And we were kind of busy with the acquisition. And it was like that I kind of frame as our Gen 1 stack, right? Like that was our dense model training stack. We were really good at doing this at hundreds of GPUs. We've been working with customers and we kind of proven it out over and over again. And that's a major thing that we do, right? We don't do this once. we have to do it once with our research team that's like creating these new capabilities and like really pushing the boundaries of what we can do. And then we have to repeat that for Databricks customers. And so it's kind of that, right? It's, and it's scaling in a lot of different ways. And so when we build these new stacks, right, that's really the crux of what's happening. So we have this new MOE architecture. It, you know, everything breaks, right? It's like, oh, we're ready to start training this. And it's like, not what? What do you mean? We're nowhere near ready, right? We need like, you know, and so a lot of this, you know, when we're doing it is almost like, you know, we're already, you know, fly, we're building an airplane literally while it's flying in the air and on fire, right? And but we do that so that you don't have to, right? And you don't do it later. And so a lot of this kind of involved, okay, now we have this MOE thing. Like, how do we split this workload across hundreds or thousands of GPUs, right? We train DB racks on over 3,000 different GPUs. What are the things that are going to fail, right? When you go from like 512 like block sizes to over 1,000, like things that didn't fail at those smaller scales are definitely failing at larger scales, you know, and you're kind of onion peeling, you're doing a lot of these things. And so like a lot of the engineering effort starts going into, hey, how are we going to solve these problems? You know, and you start by patching and, you know, and then you kind of just build up from there, you know, start understanding, hey, like checkpoint loading is breaking for some different reason than it was before. How do we make this go fast? And how do we eventually do it so that we're uptime is very long, right? And you know, I think we did pretty well. I mean, being able to train this model in 3 months or so is pretty amazing. And, you know, I think we're gonna, as we kind of commercialize the stack and start training with customers, it's gonna continue to improve and get even better.
All right, this is perfect. So actually I've got two sets of questions just based on what you just said, Bondish. Okay, so, but I'm gonna direct it to Davis. I wanted you to talk a little bit about MOE. I'm gonna do that first, but just as a lead in for the next one, then AJ, I wanna talk to you about the hardware failures and the training, because that part's super interesting that Bondish was referring to. But first things first, you know, Davis, why don't you talk a little bit about the MOE architecture? Because, you know, we went around it talking about like this idea of mixture of experts, but this is not necessarily the most obvious thing that we're talking, that typically when you're looking at Llama 2 and even the older MPT models, where we're talking about dense models, and now we're talking about sparse models. So can you talk a little bit about that, maybe within the context of the Megablocks paper, for sake of argument?
Yeah, absolutely. So here's one way to think about mixture of experts. Simple approach that you could do is you could just train different models for different subsets of your data. Like you have a model that's good at processing math, model that's good at processing Python code, whatever. You could just have different specialized models. And like you can run that, that's a thing you can do, but you'll hit a fair amount of redundancy. Like they're all going to have big embedding tables for different input tokens. They're all gonna have to figure out how to do reference resolution for pronouns. There's just a lot of the model that translates across domains and only some of it that is specific to a particular domain. So in a mixture of experts model, what you do is instead of having completely separate models, you're going to have one model, but all of the feed-forward networks, pairs of linear layers in a transformer, are going to be duplicated, say, 8 or in our case, 16 times. It'd have 16 different feed-forward networks in every transformer block. And every token is going to go to a subset of these feed-forward networks. In our case, we send each token to 4 of them. So what this means is that we have many different supposedly specialized feed-forward networks in every transformer block, and tokens go to the relevant ones. There are a bunch of things that are nice about this. One is that you have 16 times more parameters. That's a lot more model capacity. One thing that's not very nice is that you end up with 16 times more parameters in each of your layers. So that causes a number of technical challenges. As far as which experts a given token goes to, you learn a so-called routing function that hopefully does something reasonable. There are a lot of open questions about how to do this really well in the research literature, but that's kind of the high-level idea. You're adding way more parameters, but then at runtime, you use them sparsely so that each token only sees a subset of them.
So you had just mentioned the fact that we're talking about you're using 4 experts out of the 16 that are available, right? So can you provide, what is the benefit, right? Because you did note the fact that with 16 experts, you have that many more parameters to work with. So what's the benefit of doing 4 experts out of 16? And then do note the fact that when you're talking about, for example, like with Mistral and with Grok, it's 2 experts out of 8. So I'm just curious from that context.
So why 4 experts out of 16 is really 2 questions. One is why only 4 experts? And the second is why 4 and not just 1? So why choose only 4? Why choose a subset? Well, the amount of work you have to do computationally, the number of flops for each token you feed into your model is going to be proportional to the number of experts that are used. So if I take a token and I feed it through 16 different linear layers, that's of course 16 times as much work as only feeding it through 1 linear layer. So in order to reduce the amount of work we do per token, we only routed each token to a subset of the experts. Now, if that's the case, like, why not just only do 1? Why not, you know, maximize the number of ratio of parameters to the amount of work you do? And the answer there is that there's a trade-off, and you kind of have to tune it. The trade-off is that your model still does benefit from doing more work. One way to think about this intuitively is that the amount of expressiveness you get here is proportional to the like n choose k, or depends on the n choose k of how many experts you use. If there's only 1 expert, there are only 16 possible ways a token can get processed. If you have 2 out of 16 experts, you have 16 times 15 ways a token can get processed, and so on. So if you use 4, you end up with this really expressive combinatorial space where each token, you're still only using a small fraction of the parameters, but the number of functions you can express here is really, really huge. So you end up with a big model capacity win that still gets you like a lot of the benefit of having, of just using all of the experts or an equivalent dense model with the same parameter count.
Okay. And I think one of the contexts that I would add before I switch over to Ajay is that there's also the benefit of speed, right? Basically, by reducing the number of experts going overall, you've actually basically get the best of both worlds, where you basically have the higher model quality due to the 16 experts, but you actually get the better inference speed because you're using 4 experts. Did I get that correct? Just to verify here.
Yeah, that's a really good summary. Kind of getting the best of both worlds.
Cool. I probably asked Alvin Rex that question, honestly, so that is probably actually why I don't know. All right.
No, the truth.
Okay. Yeah. No. That's always been the truth. I'm not pretending I know anything. I literally asked Alvin Rex for it, and it tells me, and then I just get to cite some give me some citations that I can act like I know what I'm talking about. The one thing I definitely want to talk about, Ajay, paralyzing something like this has got to be complicated. Like, you got to tell me a little bit about the hardware failures. How do you run something like this at scale? Because that's 3,072 GPUs that you're running. This can't be like a walk in the park, right?
Yeah. So this is a fun one. So one piece of large model training. Well, fun and not fun depending on how you see it. But basically, one piece of large model training that people don't really talk about as much is how much of a systems and operations problem it really is. Throughout our time, you know, kind of running the Mosaic training platform, we had run across thousands of GPUs before, but we had never done a single training run on that many GPUs. It had been a whole bunch of smaller separate runs. And when you hit that scale, as Bandish had mentioned earlier, all sorts of things break. Statistically, actually, people say you'll observe roughly 1 GPU failure every 1,000 GPU days. And on a 3,000 GPU cluster, that means you're seeing 3 per day. And I can tell you empirically, we actually did see 3 to 4 per day throughout the entire training run. So in order to deal with this, I mean, one, you have to have really good monitoring. So we were monitoring the GPUs, we were monitoring things at the Kubernetes level, which is like the foundation of how our platform was built. But you also have to monitor the entire network, because a really critical part of training, like parallelizing this model across so many GPUs, is that you need to have really high throughput communication between all of the GPUs. So the network layer is super important. And what you end up having to do is basically check every single pair of machines are like what we call nodes in the cluster to make sure that you're actually getting that really high throughput. And many times like random network links will go down and you'll have to go figure out what they are. So there was this whole operational thing of building all of these monitoring layers, all this health checking. And then on top of that, no matter how hard you try to actually catch all these things, you will never catch everything. So the next piece of it is, okay, now in the cases where you don't catch the failures, do you have the right operations in place to be able to deal with it in a very timely manner? So we actually had a dedicated on-call rotation specifically for this training run, where if anything ever went wrong, we had a whole bunch of monitors and alerts that would be a 24/7 on-call page that would just wake people up in the middle of the night, go debug some hardware, go back to sleep, wake up again, go do it. And it kind of just went on for weeks.
That's amazing. In fact, you're literally reminding me now, this is I'm basically aging myself very horribly. I just want to call that out. Did you guys ever deal with for example, HP Superdomes? Like the old school ones? Because that's basically exactly the same thing. Like the idea was that instant and bad connections were still really, really new and they were really, really fragile at the time. So exactly the same concept. In order to just get, I was part of the SQL Server team where we were actually running SQL Server on Superdomes. And that's exactly it. Yeah. Like basically calls at all hours just because the network link wasn't working and then all hell broke loose. And so I'm just curious from your perspective, did this reduce over time as you were training training DemoRex, or was it pretty consistent anyways, just because of the nature of the infinite back connections or just nature of the GPUs themselves?
So we had pretty close relationships with the cloud providers and we were able to kind of report all of our failures after we detected and mitigated them. So we did actually see improvements in health over time. But also over time, we got a lot better at monitoring and checking for these things automatically, because every time we had something go wrong, we were able to develop some kind of script or something to like diagnose it for future times. And now we have this gigantic logbook with all of the things that went wrong. And we're actually actively working on automating all of these things so that when we have customers training models like this, they won't run into the same problems.
That's nice of you thinking about the customers.
Yep, customer first, right?
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people really enjoyed that. So there's a question coming through in the chat that I wanted to ask, which is about, have you ever experimented with training strategies other than FDSP, like using frameworks such as Megatron or DeepSpeed?
Yeah, I know. I'll be your me, whichever one. I'll be, you want to take it, and then I'll maybe add in afterwards.
Sure. Yeah. So we primarily use like a PyTorch-based training stack, and we have this library on top called Composer, which is open source, so anyone can use it. And what we've tried to do with that framework is make it as flexible as possible for different models. And you know, we use Composer to train not only our LLMs like DBRex, we also use it to train diffusion models. We have other future models coming out, and one of the reasons that's possible, in our opinion, is because we use PyTorch FSDP, which really doesn't enforce like any requirements on the model architecture. It makes it easy to distribute it across big clusters without using 3D parallelism or pipeline parallelism or anything like that. And I think that flexibility is what we were going for most of all. And we found over time that we've been able to optimize FSDP to actually achieve very, very close performance to, I think, like even these 3D parallel strategies. And so that's kind of like the trade-off we've made. I think like DeepSpeed in comparison is basically implementing the same algorithm. So whether you use DeepSpeed 0.3 versus PyTorch FSDP, I think you'll see a very similar situation. We just tend to use the PyTorch one because it's a little more natively integrated with things like PyTorch AutoCast and stuff like that. But yeah, I'll hand over to Banish as well, who's also into a lot of these different frameworks.
We love the simplicity, right? Like FSDP is like very straightforward to think about. We're able to keep optimizing it and keep pushing the bounds. And, you know, we work very closely with PyTorch on this, and that's actually been a really great partnership. But I think the other side is, you know, I think what actually AJ was talking about, like having super high speed interconnects really helps. And that's, you know, again, not everyone's going to have that. So we're not saying like things like, oh, like pipeline parallelism or different parallelism strategies aren't necessarily needed. But we, you know, when we actually build these clusters, when we train on these things, like having those high performance networks really goes a long way. And I think, you know, as we keep pushing the bounds, we'll evaluate kind of how do we keep pushing the utilization counts, and you know, we're really maximizing the amount of performance we can get per dollar. But so far, yeah, we've basically gotten away with FSDP and then kind of variations on that, and just really, really, you know, being very intelligent about how we optimize things.
All right, I'm going to lob another one out at you all because the chat has been awesome. Keep the questions coming in the chat. You all are incredible. So what tools do you use to benchmark your LLM inference regarding latency, GPU utilization, et cetera, et cetera?
So I know the inference people have some very specific tooling that we didn't use to pre-train it necessarily, but it's mostly off-the-shelf stuff. We get a lot of mileage out of the PyTorch profiler as well as the PyTorch memory profiler. I think those two were about 80% of it. Occasionally, we would also use just like a little bit of our own tooling to say log all the distributed calls, but it was mostly off-the-shelf stuff. And I think for inference, a lot of the challenges there are maybe less around which tool are you using, because you can often indirect to, say, very high-performance kernels in TRTLM or other libraries, where you can kind of get away with not looking at like the hardware perf counters and the L2 cache bandwidth and so on a pretty good fraction of the time. But it's often hard to get a good representation of your workloads, especially when your workloads are very bursty. Because, okay, what your inference latency is going to depend on your batch size. Like, how much work are you doing right now? How many other queries are you having to answer? And how do you get a realistic setting so you can measure that in a situation that's going to be relevant for what your customers are seeing? So it's not quite an answer, but I know we had to build a fair amount of scaffolding around that to really get accurate answers to these sorts of questions.
Yeah, so just to quickly add on to what Davis is saying, there's like the inference latency piece, and for inference specifically, there's also throughput, which matters a lot. So one thing we did for serving DBRX is actually we built our own kind of optimized inference web server that has a whole bunch of customizations in it to make the model super performant when it's being served. And the way we test this is actually the very simple: deploy the model using the server and then absolutely bombard it with requests and see what throughput we're able to get. There's nothing like basically trying to simulate live actual workloads and then from there measuring the performance and then optimizing from there.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add, I think the inference is definitely a full kind of end-to-end in that sense, like systems problem, right? Like AJ is talking about the web server that we have to kind of optimize all the way from sort of the REST API call to the actual model call itself, right? So we've written a great blog post about this, and it kind of highlights our inference benchmarking. So, we look at things like time per output token or time to first token, time for the generate calls to actually happen. And, one is compute bound, the other is memory bound. And also we look at kind of memory bandwidth utilization. So we kind of highlight that framework, definitely would point folks to that blog. And then in terms of actual tooling for the model, right? I mean, a lot of it is like, okay, how do we get those metrics? And so a lot of it kind of looks at, okay, hey, like, what do we expect, right? Like, if we know the how much data we're moving around, we know the feeds and the speeds of the system, what should we actually expect to see in terms of model performance? And then we also use a lot of the vendor tools, right? Like, I know we've actually looked at things like Insight from NVIDIA to actually model kind of like how long certain kernels are taking. And a lot of that also happens in partnership with those vendors, right? Like we work very closely with the TRTLM team to really optimize that. And that's kind of how, what led to those, those PRs to the TRTLM repo and the VLLM repos for both of those solutions.
Beyond the chinchilla model or beyond the chinchilla scaling guidelines, how did you choose the number of tokens to pre-train on? And maybe I'll call out Abi on this one.
Oh, and just as a quick call out before you do it, most people probably here don't even know what the chinchilla guidelines are, right? They probably haven't read the research paper around this. Again, I only know because I've asked Tom and Rex to tell me. So why don't you provide the context first? Just want to call that out. That all.
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes to training these models, a lot of times you're trying to produce the highest quality for a given compute function. And compute is kind of basically a product between how many parameters, how many tokens you use. And so if you look back at the history of like LLM scaling, in the early days, people were training very, very large models on a small number of tokens. GPT-3 was kind of like this. I think 175 billion parameters, only 300 billion tokens. And they tried to develop scaling laws to predict what was the most optimal way to assign those two components, the parameters and the tokens. Now, a few years later, there was a paper that basically trained a model called Chinchilla, and they remeasured the scaling laws more precisely. And they found that actually you want to have a lot more tokens than parameters. So they came to a recommendation that is approximately about a 1 to 20 ratio. So if you want to train a 100 billion parameter model, you should use actually 2 trillion tokens. And so that actually dramatically changed how people built models. People started building smaller models, trained on much more data. Beyond that, people found that, hey, actually, we can extend it even farther. Although it's not exactly compute optimal, you can train on even more tokens. So you can increase that ratio from 20x to 100x, even 200x. And then you get models like the Llama models from Meta. So for example, Llama 7b is only a 7 billion parameter model, but trained for 2 trillion tokens. So that's a humongous ratio, way beyond Chinchilla and so on. So we look at all these different strategies, and we know for our customers, basically being able to build models efficiently, so the smallest parameter size possible, is really important. So we basically want to ask ourselves, what is the highest token to parameter ratio we can achieve without giving too much quality away? So not quite Chinchilla, not quite like extremely like large amounts of tokens. And we did a lot of experiments at smaller scale, basically at the same compute budgets, where we would try to shrink the model and increase the token count as much as possible to basically see where that trade-off was. So I think when you look at Dabarexidae, it has basically 132 billion total parameters and 12 trillion tokens. So it's pretty close to 100x. And I think that's what we kind of came to. So if you're interested in these kinds of scaling laws, there are new papers out there for mixture of expert scaling laws. I think there's one even just from a few weeks ago. But that's how we came to it.
Let's talk a little bit about the data quality, like in terms of one of the recurring themes from the blog post was just that the higher quality data. So we can break it down in terms of, for example, the GPT-4 tokenizer, right, from TikToken. We can talk about from the standpoint that we have higher quality data, which resulted in us doing the dense MOEA versus MPT-7B, right? So I'd like to chime in a little bit about that, just to provide the context that we end up utilizing the very data tools that Databricks has. I'm not trying to upsell that, by the way. I'm just calling out that we're from Databricks, so cool. We end up using our own tools. We end up dogfooding ourselves, basically, to go ahead and actually produce, get high quality data so that we could go ahead and actually produce models like that. And that's more open for anybody here right now at this point.
I think you should upsell it. I think when we moved from Mosaic to Databricks, I think our data processing literally got 100x faster. Like, I'm not even exaggerating. It became much, much, much easier to deal with these huge text data sets.
I think it was pretty remarkable for our data team, because obviously when you're dealing with many terabytes of data, that's not something you want to do on your laptop. So getting everyone on board with Spark and having the ability to write something, you know, kind of pandas-like, like something fairly familiar, but that kind of just works at scale, was really helpful. We had a very interesting time exploring the data, trying to run all sorts of different transformations, keeping track of everything, because you try lots of different experiments, you try lots of different pre-processing. You have these whole data science pipelines to go from raw text to this subset of really clean data that you actually want to use. So yeah, it ended up working really well getting acquired by Databricks. Like, honestly, I think that when we first found out, it was a little bit like, oh, Databricks, okay. Right, not like the first company you think of as deep learning, but in retrospect, seeing how much of the work is the data pipeline and data management, and how much alpha there is in doing that really well, it's like, oh, this makes total sense. Like, I really see the integration here. So it's been a very positive experience for everyone who's had to crunch large data sets here.
Ben Deesh, I know you got something for us.
Oh, yeah, sure. So I think one of the things that was actually interesting, I mean, like, we're kind of talking about why this was like a match made in heaven, right? Like, we, you know, and I think we talked about this a few weeks ago too, like, our data processing sped up so much after the Databricks acquisition, right? Because it just, we have, you know, these experts, and this is this amazing system that, and this platform that we built to do this. And then once you have that data, you have to pump it
into 3,000 plus GPUs and actually train these jobs, right? And so this was actually a problem that we had started working on at Mosaic. But you know, especially when you have these cloud built platforms, the underlying storage is object storage, right? And so when you want to distribute this data, right, where you, I mean, at scale, right, we're running one training job, but we're carving up the work and kind of giving it to these different GPUs. And in order to do that, you also have to take your data and split it up and send it to these different GPUs. So doing that at 1,000 GPU scale is, you know, turns out it's really difficult. And also then streaming it over the internet or streaming it over a kind of high bandwidth network also comes with its own set of problems. So for, you know, anyone who's been on the other side of a DDoS attack, you know, you kind of hit these issues, especially when you're like pinging these service providers. And so, you know, splitting up that data and then really streaming it or chunking it up, downloading it, making sure that you're downloading stuff that you're going to need next in the background, being able to shuffle it at scale and then kind of, you know, reorganize it to all these different GPUs. You know, that's kind of what our streaming data sets library lets us do. And you know, it's really just even gotten better and more capable, right, to kind of train the scale of this model with DBrex.
Yeah, I think the streaming team... I was just going to say, like, out of all the different pieces of infrastructure we had, all the different tools, I think streaming is the one piece that didn't break at all as we scaled
up.
So it was just pretty remarkable.
It was pretty amazing. By the way, that's like almost a one-person team in a lot of sense. Like, that's like, you know, it's like, it is impressive what those guys, like, that guy does. But like, yeah, no, I mean, it's an incredible piece of engineering that we kind of built there.
Yeah,
I think you want to chime in too. So go for it.
Another fun story about kind of scaling up our data. So our streaming data loader held up and was very scalable. Object stores, on the other hand, not as much. So fun story, we actually had to switch object stores at one point and then also implement some hacks to be able to download the data and not get throttled or have other issues with object store in the cloud providers, just because we were, not necessarily with data, but also with checkpoint download when we're launching a whole bunch of training runs. When you start to really scale up, you start to make the object stores unhappy. So,
yeah, and
especially when you're trying to list them, right? So, yeah, like the listing alone, basically, you're doing a DDoS attack directly on the object stores.
Yeah,
so that's always
pretty much. Yeah,
yeah,
you have thousands of these workers just blasting away. So, sorry, go ahead, Abhi.
Yeah, no, I think what was cool about that is like some of them were things in our libraries where we had done at first like what seemed like the natural thing to do. Hey, you know, every GPU should go download the metadata file, right? That can't be so bad, right? And that's totally fine when you only have 100 GPUs. That's like when you have 3,000 to the object store, it looks like you're spamming them and you get like shut down. So then we had to like put in all these fixes, which totally makes sense, you know, like just one guy downloaded and then shared the metadata or something like that. But now that we've actually fixed these, our customers won't see these problems at all, which is kind of cool.
Cool, cool. So before Demetrios takes over, I just wanted to do a quick call out because Davis did bring that up. He said, you don't want to run this on your laptop. Now, I did want to clarify, that's running on your laptop for training, which we completely agree with it. If you go get the quantized version, I think, Abhi, correct me, is the guy from Apple who actually quantized DoubleRex down. If you've got, I think you were telling me, a 96 gigabyte MacBook Pro, you should be able to go ahead and run inference directly on the laptop itself.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So there are at least a couple high-end laptops which can run it. I think the Llama CPP folks are also working on it, so hopefully that'll open up today.
Yeah. No, I've been playing with that myself, and then my poor little Mac Studio is not surviving this right.
You should be able to run it. Like, I think once Llama CPP or, you know, you should be able to run it on your gaming rig at home right after it's quantized.
Yeah, I know, but see, I only have 32 gigs on this one, so it's just an excuse for me to buy more memory now.
Yeah,
that's all. So you gotta help me out here. Come on, dude.
Exactly. Quality.
That's
check.
Yeah. That's personal. I don't know. That's like, that's just 32 gigs. I mean, come on.
Yeah, that's.
Yeah, like, I know. I feel really horrible right now. No, I don't, back on track. Demetrios, go for it, buddy.
We digress, but. There is this data quality issue, and there was a question coming through in the chat that I think is great, which was about thinking about future models is moving towards synthetic data modalities on the roadmap.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a research area we're very interested in, particularly because as we try to ramp to even larger models, we're starting to run out of just data on the internet. You know, I think, you know, one of the core beliefs we had with training custom models is that there's actually more useful data held privately by enterprises, right? And like potentially that's like a way for people to tap into it. With Synthetica, I think we found even with DBRex, and we're just trying to experiment with this, that basically being able to take a small data set that you have and expand it, and then like fine tune that is helping a lot. And we're trying to figure out ways to do that with our customers as well. So generally like very interested in synthetic data, and hopefully in the coming months, stuff will have more to say about.
Oh, sorry. Just had a quick add on to that. So on the topic of a lot of our research eventually funneling into the product and things we offer to customers, one of the biggest, so we actually have a fine-tuning API and coming soon ability to fine-tune DBRX as well. And one thing that we really learned through a lot of our customer conversations is that customers struggle to have very large labeled data sets for supervised fine-tuning. And synthetic data is one really great way to kind of address that. And that's something that we're actually looking at first, obviously doing all the research on and deeply understanding ourselves, but then eventually actually building into the fine-tuning offering as well. So very much on the roadmap.
Perfect. No, so I just realized basically both from what you're talking about, in terms of the latest research, one thing we may or may not have discussed was curriculum learning. And I was wondering if one of you can chime in a little bit about that, because that actually had to do a lot with the improvement for training as well. I just realized, because we talked about the tokenizer, we talked about data, but I forgot about the curriculum learning. Anybody want to chime in on that one?
I can chime in a little bit. So what we found is that, and we did found this through small scale experiments, that it helps a lot to kind of change the distribution of your data towards the end of pre-training. So we did these experiments where in the last 10% or 20% of training, we would focus the pre-training data on less just web scale text and more on like the high quality data or code data that we actually wanted them all to be really good at. And that turned out to help performance a lot on the sort of benchmarks that we care about. So for DBRX, broadly, we wanted a general purpose LLM that was also particularly really good at like coding and reasoning. So when we basically tailored the pre-trained data towards that, and again, this is really easy with our tools because we use these kind of streams and you can change the ratio of the streams at runtime. That helped a lot in the final performance. And I think actually when we talked about with some of our reporters as well, we tried out different data mixes. And so this is actually like a pretty like exciting moment during the building of DBRX. And we found that the curriculum learning one worked the best.
Which is, by the way, I don't know. I mean, that is super exciting to me, right? Like you know, because you hear all these stories about people who like are spend a lot of money trying to like take these base models, you know, fine tune them or change things. And I think like if we can get really good at continuing to teach these models more and more effectively, you know, and kind of get away from, hey, I added a bunch of my data, but the model actually got worse and a bunch of other stuff. You know, if we can kind of crack that, that's kind of amazing. And that's what's like super exciting, I think, about being able to kind of like change the data mix during training, you know, like kind of look at where it's at if you have good evals in place and then kind of tweak it as you're going along, right? You're almost kind of like figuring out what you can continue to teach the model. So really looking forward to kind of like what we kind of keep developing on that front.
So there's an awesome question that came through the chat again from Max. And I think this one is directed towards you, AJ.
For a large scale training, generally switch to Slurm instead of K8. Does K8 affect your training, the pipeline? And what factors could you make you switch from K8 to Slurm?
Oh, so that's an interesting one. So the reason why we chose Kubernetes is actually because we were building this training platform to be multi-cloud and also to be something customer-facing. And Kubernetes is significantly easier to build multi-cloud. You can run on AWS, Azure, Oracle, GCP, wherever, much more easily than you can with Slurm. And that was actually the big reason. Like at the end of the day, when we built our product, our research team is treated just like a customer to an extent. And our research team plus all of our customers running multi-cloud, Kubernetes is just significantly easier. Now, in terms of scalability, yes, there's a point there. I think Kubernetes, once you really scale up the number of machines and the amount of hardware it's managing, you have some challenges in scaling, but those are things that we actually built workarounds for within our own platform to deal with. Because at the end of the day, Kubernetes is simply, you can think of as the foundational layer that manages the hardware, but we've built a whole stack of systems on top of it to really enable this large scale training.
The whole chat wants to know this question, which is smaller models on the roadmap?
I mean, why? You know, we just got to go bigger. No, I mean, yeah, you know,
I think, you know, I think, again, like, I think what we're doing is making, we're trying to make this available to a lot of different market segments, right? And so small bottles, big bottles, you know, everything in between, I think, are things that are fair game. You can train a smaller model, right, with Databricks, if that's really what you need. But, you know, I think longer term, we want to support as many use cases as we can for our customers. And so that's kind of how we'll tackle it.
Excellent. All right. This is the last one I think that we can hit before the end. It's going to be a rapid fire round so that we can all make our next meeting on time. And speaking on the topic of fine tuning, if we go with QLoRa or some sort of LoRa for what are you calling it again? DBX.
DabaRex, man.
DabaRex, that's it.
You got to work with me, buddy.
It's going to stay. One of these times it'll stick in my head. Anyway, lightning round. QLoRa or some sort of LoRa for DabaRex, which framework would you suggest? How many GPUs would make sense?
I think for QLoRa, we are working on modifying the Transformers integration to make it easier to use. I don't know exactly which frameworks are best for right now. We are working on LoRa fine-tuning support just in LM Foundry, which is our public training repo. So check that out and post an issue there, depending on what you're looking for. But yeah, you can also take a look at just the Transformers repo where we're working on our basically PR right now.
Excellent. So I think that is all for today. The last thing, Jonathan got back to us in the chat for you, AJ, about the flavor of Kubernetes and was asking, was it OpenShift, Rancher? What did you use to manage the Kubernetes cluster, if anything?
So very, very early on, we used to use Rancher for a lot of our stuff, but we actually replaced large components of Rancher with our own stack over time. For some of the more established cloud providers like AWS, GCP, we'll just use their managed one and build on top of that. On OCI, we'll kind of roll one of our own like open source distributions of Kubernetes.
Guys, I feel like we could have continued this for another hour. The chat is going wild. We didn't get to half of the questions, and I appreciate everyone that came and was able to talk with me. I also appreciate everyone that is in the chat being super active, and we're going to be doing more of these. So stick around, and we will probably be emailing you when we have the next one. I really appreciate this. If anyone wants to dive in deeper, Davis and Bandish and I had a podcast about 3 weeks ago that came out, and it talked a lot about the different pains that you all felt when you were going through this. So we dove deep into it. I want to thank you guys so much. Even though I can only see your frozen faces, I'm visualizing you smiling and being very happy right now.
Ooh, I'll vouch for you, buddy. We're all happy right now, so we're good. And thank you very much to everybody who's watching us. We really appreciate you guys diving in. And like always, Dimitros, thank you very much, man. This is always glad to join.
This was awesome.
Thank you so much. So much fun. Thank you for hosting.
This was great. Thank you all. We will see y'all later. Have a good one.